Hello, I'm Lynn Malcolm on RN, and very pleased to begin a new season of All in the Mind on a musical note, an insight into our human obsession with music.
At its essence, music moves us because it serves as a metaphor for emotional life. Like life, music speeds up and it slows down and it stops to breathe a bit. It has peaks and valleys of tension and release. It mimics the dynamics of our emotional life.
That's Daniel Levitin, one-time rock musician and record producer turned neuroscientist. And this composer was inspiration to renowned neurologist Oliver Sacks and his writings on music and the brain.
Music came very naturally to me. That was better than most of the other kids who were taking piano. My earliest memories were improvising music at the piano. Finally, my parents got me a piano when I was in third grade, so I guess I was 8.
And you were really desperate to get going.
Yeah, I was. And my teachers commented on my report cards that there was a change in me ever since the piano came into my house.
What sort of a change?
They seemed to think it made me happier because I had seemed to them to be a rather unhappy child. They noticed that I couldn't sit still, but they didn't know at that time that I had Tourette's syndrome.
More from the extraordinary New York composer Tobias Picker later on his relationship with Oliver Sacks and how creating music tames the symptoms of his neurological disorder. Daniel Levitin played rock music from childhood and in his early adult life worked as sound engineer recording the music groups such as Steely Dan, Stevie Wonder, Santana and the Grateful Dead. He then became so fascinated by why music beguiles human beings so powerfully that he began research on music in the brain. He's now a professor of psychology and neuroscience at McGill University in Montreal, Quebec. His latest book is called This Is Your Brain on Music and looks at why and how music moves us.
There's a particular part of the brain I've been studying for 15 years that holds a key to at least part of the question. That part of the brain is in the prefrontal cortex, and it goes by the rather inelegant but technical name Brodmann Area 47. And Brodmann Area 47 is responsible for helping us to form expectations about what's going to happen in the world. You can imagine this is a very important part of our evolution, right? If it rains, you have to be able to know you're going to get wet, and if you bite into a piece of rotten fruit, you're going to have to know you're going to get sick. And when we listen to music, Brodmann 47 is exquisitely active, trying to predict what's going to come next in the music.
So musicians are able to manipulate that, I guess, in the patterns of music that they produce.
You're absolutely right. That's a lot of what musicians do. If they're not improvising and they're playing from a score, as you do in classical music, the musician can't choose what notes to play, but he or she can sure choose how to play them. And they're manipulating our emotions by playing around with the timing of the notes, the timbre, the loudness of the notes. So to give an example, let's take Beethoven's Für Elise, a well-known piano piece that almost every child learns to play. If you were to play the notes as they're indicated on the score, it would sound like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, very flat, right? But no self-respecting pianist plays it that way. They lengthen some of the notes, they shorten others, they speed up, they slow down in order to capture the dynamics of emotional life, so you might hear it some more like dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da-dee. And that conveys some sense of expectation and release.
In a sense, some unpredictability in music is what attracts us to some types of music and not others.
Right, so the brain is a giant pattern detector. It's looking for patterns and changes in those patterns. If we play a piece of music perfectly robotically, the brain becomes, you know, uninterested and bored. It's because the musicians are able to bring this kind of expressive quality to it that the brain is excited. And of course, the composers are playing the same game. If they compose a melody that's perfectly predictable, you get bored. On the other end of the extreme, if the music's too unpredictable, we're disoriented. The job of the composer is to hit the balance just right, so that our expectations are rewarded much of the time, but violated in interesting ways the rest of the time. And it's Brodmann 47, this area in the prefrontal cortex, that's keeping track of all that.
You're also known for drawing attention to the role of another part of the brain, the cerebellum, in certain styles of music. Tell me about that.
The cerebellum is a bundle of fibers. It's Latin for little brain. It's in the back of the skull, right where your neck attaches to the back of your head. And it was thought for many decades that the cerebellum's sole function was to help maintain regular timing, such as when we walk or run, to maintain a steady gait. And we've known that the cerebellum is responsible for motor control. And it's only in the last 10 or 15 years that we've gained an appreciation for how the cerebellum is involved in human emotion. And its role in music is particularly interesting because it's the body's, the brain's central timekeeper. These kinds of deviations in timing that we were just talking about, they're being predicted by the prefrontal cortex, but the cerebellum's keeping track of whether things are happening with metronomic robotic regularity or not. And it has all these connections to the frontal cortex and the limbic system, the seats of human emotion, meaning that the cerebellum is acting as kind of a gateway to emotion.
So music is actually affecting many different parts of the brain, depending on what aspect of music we're talking about.
Music is affecting many different parts of the brain. In fact, from the various scanning studies that have been done to date, it seems as though music activates more regions of the brain than almost anything else we know about. Whether you're listening or playing or composing, music is a multi-network stimulus that activates the front of the brain, the back, the left, the right, the surface, and the areas deep inside.
I think many of us have had that experience of hearing just a small bit of music from our past and a whole lot of memories come flooding back and a whole lot of emotions come flooding back. What is the connection between music and our memory?
Many of us in the cognitive neuroscience field now believe that almost everything you've experienced gets encoded in memory. So the hard part is pulling it out, though. We've got all these memories in there, and they compete with one another when we try to access them. What you want, in the parlance of the field, is a retrieval cue, something that will act as bait to pull out not just all the fish in memory, but a particular fish. So the bait has to be very particular. The thing about music, or smells for that matter, is that many of them tend to be associated with a very particular time in our lives. And especially in the last 50 years, if you look at popular music, songs become hits for a summer, and they're played constantly, and then they disappear. That's exactly what you want in a retrieval cue, because it's uniquely associated with a time and place and with other memories of your life. So you hear that song that you haven't heard since you were 12, and instantly all of the other things that you were experiencing at the age of 12 come back in a flood. It wouldn't work with something like God Save the Queen or the National Anthem or a song that you're hearing all the time. It works because it's so specific.
So you often find that people sort of very late in their lives, even if they've got Alzheimer's disease or some form of dementia, they can remember songs from when they were teenagers.
Yeah, I thought a lot about this. And as you say, we've now seen many, many patients in old age homes and nursing homes and hospitals, and they can forget what year it is, what city they're in, how old they are, their spouse's name. And yet, they remember all these songs, typically from about the age of 10 to 14. They can sing along, they remember the melody and the words. Why would this be so? I think part of it is the nature of how music is represented in the brain. Music has all these different components. There's melody, there's rhythm, there's the lyrics, there's the tempo, the pitches, the harmony. And we now know that these are served by different neural networks, different regions of the brain. So there are these multiply reinforcing and redundant cues within memory. You may not be able to access all of them, but if you can get just a few, they trigger the others. I think the other thing is that in terms of lyrics, music is tightly structured. Music has a certain tempo and it has an accent structure. It's not just 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Certain notes happen on the heavy beats and other notes happen on the light beats. You add in the lyrics, which typically have to rhyme at the end of the line and the lyrics have to fit in with the melody. Even if you don't remember every single word, there aren't that many others that could fit. So your brain figures out what it must be and fills it in.
And you write that music is a better tool than language for arousing feelings and emotions. What is the basis for that in the brain?
Well, language tends to be representational. It tends to be very concrete. Music is more metaphorical, and that ambiguity in it can allow it to mean different things to different people. I'll give you an example. Music that tends to be happy tends to have short notes and a lot of leaps in the melody and a fast tempo. And this is because it's modeling how we move when we're happy. We walk quickly, we take big steps, we might jump, we are buoyant in our good moods. And when we're sad, our body's a bit stooped, we move more slowly, we take shorter steps, and the music mirrors all of this.
Is music an essential part of human evolution? The jury is still out on this in academic circles. For example, the renowned cognitive scientist Steven Pinker calls music auditory cheesecake, meaning that music didn't evolve for any biological function, that it's just an evolutionary accident. But Daniel Levitin believes that the evolution of the brain has made music possible.
And yes, and I would go a step further and say that I think music has made the evolution of the brain possible. We may never know, but I'm a scientist and I'm looking at the weight of the evidence. One piece of evidence is that we have particular neurochemical systems that respond to music. When we listen to music, oxytocin is released. This is a bonding hormone. When we listen to sad music, prolactin is released, a soothing hormone. Playing music and listening to music can cause the release of dopamine, a reward hormone. So for neurochemical systems to be involved suggests some kind of evolution. Another piece of evidence that I find compelling is that music and language occupy very different neural circuits. They're separable. We've seen many patients now who, as a result of a stroke or a tumor or some other brain damage, lose one system and not the other. That is the system of language or the system of music. So if music really built on top of language, you wouldn't expect them to be separable in these ways.
On RN, I'm Lynn Malcolm with you on All in the Mind. Today, our musical minds. This is from the musical work Four Etudes for Ursula by New York composer Tobias Picker. From the time he was very young, he had a remarkable musical ability. But he was a sad child because he was afflicted with Tourette's syndrome, a neuropsychiatric disorder which causes uncontrolled physical and sometimes vocal twitching movements, or tics. So Tourette's syndrome, how did Tourette's syndrome affect you?
It seemed to be something I didn't seem to be able to control, but I was constantly being told to control myself and to stop it.
So you had sharp movements and tics, did you?
Yes, I did. Nobody knew what it was. They thought I was a nervous child. That's what they called it, nervous. Nothing was known about it, at least not in the New York City metropolitan area where I grew up in the early 1960s. It wasn't until later, when Oliver Sacks started writing about it, that it became recognizable to physicians and psychologists. I could vent my emotions through playing the piano, most especially my rage. So I was very good at playing loud, fast, angry music.
So you found music was a real outlet for your anger and your rage?
Yes, it was. I also was controlled. I was able to forget the tics and things that came at Tourette's when I was performing. So from the time I started being able to perform at the piano in an impressive way, which was pretty quick, it was important to me that people knew, before I would allow anyone to come close to me, that I had this ability in which I could control something very powerful, a very big piano, the king of instruments, that I could wield my control over it, was a compensation for my inability to control the tics, the twitching, as it was called. When I'd achieved a certain level of recognition and accomplishment as a composer, also after many, many years of therapy, a lot of that fell away, and I became interested in meeting people just as myself.
British neurologist Oliver Sacks, known for his collections of case studies, including The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, became mesmerized by Tobias Picker because of his extraordinary musical ability, combined with his neuropsychiatric disorder. He wrote about him in his book Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain. Tobias Picker tells of their meeting.
We met about 20 years ago through a mutual friend who had Parkinson's, who introduced us. I gave a dinner party and invited them. I took a Valium before they arrived because I was nervous and had the effect of eliminating all of my tics. So Oliver's first impression of me was somebody that, if anything, had a very negligible case of Tourette syndrome. And it wasn't for a couple of more years until I could show him a film that was taken of me at a rehearsal. And the film showed my Tourette's in full bloom. He did see how my body was in constant motion listening to a rehearsal of my Second Symphony. And he watched it over and over and asked me many questions about Tourette's and music.
I think he said that he thought your Tourette's excited your musical imagination. Do you agree with that?
We talked about this energy that Tourette's seems to be, this unbridled energy that when corralled or focused into music, it does tend to inform some of the musical choices and spur the imagination. So yeah, I would agree with it. Someone said to me yesterday, while we were rehearsing a new opera of mine in San Francisco, Dolores Claiborne, based on a book by Stephen King, and there was a little reception and one of the singers from my cast sang an aria from my aria, and then she sang an aria from Falstaff. And the woman who was driving me home said to me, I was watching you while Susanna was singing your aria and then the Verdi aria. And she said, during the Verdi, your body was moving constantly in most interesting ways, and you didn't stop moving. It seemed as though the music was going through you or having some effect on you to such a degree that I suddenly became very interested in hearing your opera and interested in your music. I had no idea I was moving while I was listening to Verdi. And I said, was I moving listening to my own music? And she said, no, you were not. And she didn't know I had Tourette's syndrome. So you know, it's always there whether I'm aware of it or not. I'm surprised often when people mention it.
In 2010, Tobias Picker completed his first ballet inspired by Oliver Sacks' 1973 book, Awakenings. It tells the story of those who were victims of the 1920s encephalitis lethargic epidemic and their treatment with the drug L-DOPA, a drug later successful in treating Parkinson's disease. In writing the ballet, Tobias Picker greatly valued the references Oliver Sacks made to music in his book.
I underlined all of the references to music that Oliver invented to describe their tics as motifs in conceiving the music. It's astounding how much he relates the tics that these people were afflicted by in musical terms. It's replete with marvelous use of musical terminology to describe tics.
What was Oliver Sacks' reaction when he first saw Awakenings, the ballet?
Well, I played it for him before he saw it, and he was very moved by the music. He could envision the people that he wrote about when he listened to the music, so he thought I'd captured some essence of those people. He thought I'd written a masterpiece, he said. When he came to see the ballet, I heard that he was speechless. But I think he was quite impressed to see this quite sophisticated choreography attempting to do something with his writings about the sufferers and awakening.
New York composer Tobias Picker. Daniel Levitin and his colleagues at McGill University believe that music has huge potential in therapeutic settings to contribute to our greater health and well-being. They've just published a paper on this called Music and Neurochemistry, Evidence for Health Outcomes.
One of the things we found in our literature review that was intriguing is a series of studies where patients in a hospital who are about to undergo an operation are either given a Valium or they're given music to listen to, calming, soothing music. Valium's a class of drugs called benzodiazepines that are known to relax people. The surprising finding was that more people felt calm as a result of the music than they did as a result of the Valium. So the music had a more beneficial effect for much less money and with fewer side effects. Another finding that we've seen replicated many, many times is that music can increase your physiological pain threshold. It means you feel less pain when you're listening to music that you like.
It has to be music that appeals to an individual's taste, does it, for it to have the most powerful effect?
Exactly. So I don't think we're going to see a day where the doctor prescribes a particular piece of music for people to listen to. What the doctor will say is that distracting music may help you with this pain, and you know, music therapists may help you to identify the music and can help us to understand the health benefits.
So how much do we know about what determines somebody's musical taste?
That's an interesting question. You're hitting all the music cognition greatest hits here. Musical tastes begin to form in the womb. The developing baby by the age of 20 weeks has a fully functioning auditory system. As the developing baby is growing in the womb, he or she is experiencing all the music that the mother is and trying to wire up its brain to make sense of it so that by the age of 1 year, babies show a preference for the music they heard in the womb. So the first part of what we like is familiarity. All Western music is based on the same musical rules. So when we talk about heavy metal or classical or jazz or country, mainstream popular music, we're talking about music that adheres to the same 12 tones, the same scale, the same rules, as distinct from, say, Indian music or Aboriginal Australian music or Arabian music or Chinese music. Those have their own scales and their own rules. If you grow up listening to any of them, you internalize those rules, just as you internalize the rules of language, and you at least can understand that music and form preferences within that system. Then a third part of it is that in our early teen years, we tend to gravitate towards music that helps to brand us and our social identity. At that age, 11, 12, 13, 14, we realize for the first time in our lives that we don't have to just like what our parents like. We can have our own tastes and our own opinions. And part of that social identity is dressing in a particular way, liking certain books, certain movies, and certain music.
The last time I saw Richard was Detroit in 68, and he told me all romantics meet the same fate someday. Okay, so I'm about to share my all-time favorite in the early teenage years, and I couldn't help but notice that a couple of years ago you interviewed her, Canadian singer-songwriter Joni Mitchell, one of my all-time favorites. And
mine too.
Oh, really? And she talked about the time when she was making the album Blue. It was at her most vulnerable time emotionally, and she really shared so much of herself. And she said that a couple of young fans came up to her and said, before Prozac, there was you, indicating that the sense that the music had a therapeutic value for them.
That's a powerful statement, isn't it?
It is.
So I think what's happening is that the Blue album was very self-disclosive, and of course Joni was writing about herself, and that's one of the beautiful paradoxes of art, is that through the intimately personal, art can become universal. Because although not every girl had a boyfriend named Richard, when Joni sings The Last Time I Saw Richard, it's easy to put yourself in that place and to feel those same things. And I think when we're sad, any of us, one of the things that happens is that we feel alone and misunderstood. And then a singer like Joni comes along, and you suddenly feel less alone. Here's somebody who's been through some of the same mess and difficulty, and is talking about it in a particularly articulate way and in a sensitive way, and we no longer feel alone. There's this wonderfully therapeutic effect of the sad music that picks you up. You're understood. I'm so glad you didn't tell me that you spent your teenage years listening to Rick Springfield. I didn't know where that was going.
Love so sweet. When you're gonna get yourself back on your feet? Love can be so sweet. Daniel Levitin and I did go on a little longer about Joni Mitchell, but I'll spare you from that. Each to his or her own, as they say. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Join me on All in the Mind next week when we continue an exploration of the power of music and its therapeutic value. Guest book and music details relating to today's program are on the All in the Mind website from abc.net.au/radionational. And I'd love you to leave a comment on the site too and sign up for the All in the Mind podcast if you haven't done it yet. Until next week, bye for now. Next on RN, The Philosopher's Zone with Joe Gelonesi. Only a doctor could defy, and my God just means to fly away. Only a thing.